This is Larry Jones. You are listening to the Grace and Glory Hour with Pastor David M. Atkinson. Thank you for joining us today. We appreciate your interest and request that you pray for this ministry. Our email address is graceglory7@juno.com. graceglory7@juno.com. Now here is Pastor Atkinson.
Let's turn just momentarily to Psalm 118. I said that we would very briefly conclude our look at the text of John Wycliffe. Psalm 118, verse 70. This is Wycliffe's text. I shall not die, but live, and declare the works of the Lord. We have seen that this was part of the Egyptian Hallel. It was sung by the Jewish people as they prepared for Passover, and it was certainly sung by Jesus himself as he led the disciples in that upper room at that Passover, which then merged into the Lord's Supper, called often the Last Supper. It was sung by Jesus. And I said that John Phillips, that magnificent British expositor, now with the Lord, entitled Psalm 118, The Journey Home, The Journey Home. And it is specifically the Lord's journey home. The Lord's journey home to that beautiful city with a street of gold and gates of pearl and walls of jasper. John Phillips very poetically and I think validly says that this 118th Psalm is a picture of Jesus and the Lord's journey home. And we've seen that John Phillips says there are four major stops on the Lord's journey home. The first one is described in verses 5 through 7 of Psalm 118, verses 5 through 7. That first major stop is Gethsemane. We saw that the second major stop, Psalm 118, verses 8 and 9, was Gabbatha, or the pavement, Pilate's judgment hall, where he examined Jesus and came to the conclusion that he found no fault in him, but nevertheless caved to political pressure, caved into the pressures of Rome, and delivered Jesus to be crucified. That was the second major stop on the Lord's journey home, Gabbatha, verses 8 and 9. And then I will simply mention the final two stops, verses 10 through 13, would speak of Golgotha. Verses 10 through 13, Golgotha. All nations compass me about, but in the name of the Lord will I destroy them. They compass me about, yea, they compass me about, but in the name of the Lord I will destroy them. They compass me about like bees. They are quenched as the fire of thorns, for in the name of the Lord I will destroy them. Thou hast thrust sore at me that I might fall, but the Lord helped me. This third stop on the Lord's journey home is the stop at Golgotha. Now, I notice the imprecation, the imprecatory prayer in these verses, in the name of the Lord, I will destroy them. I would hardly ever choose a passage like this for us to read together on the Sunday morning. It's inspired. It's inspired. It's inerrant. But I would hardly ever choose it because there's only one, in my opinion, for whom it's appropriate to say, in the name of the Lord, I will destroy them. I don't have the right to say that. I'm a sinner. Now, several throughout history, no doubt have claimed these imprecatory, judgment-filled verses. In the name of the Lord, I will destroy them. You can see a demagogue who knows just enough of the Bible to be dangerous. You can see a pastor who gets out of control and feels he's threatened. And he feels like there's enemies in the congregation. And he forgets himself and becomes imprecatory because he's fixated on real or imagined enemies. And he says to a deacon or another member, in the name of the Lord, I will destroy them. I'm sure that throughout history, several have claimed these judgment-filled verses. However, in my opinion, these verses essentially and properly can only belong to the sinless, faultless Son of God. Jesus is the only one, in my opinion, who has the right to say, in the name of the Lord, I will destroy them. I don't have that right. I'm a sinner. I'm not perfect. I'm no more perfect than my real or imagined enemies. And I have no right to say, in the name of the Lord, I will destroy them. But Jesus, the perfect, sinless, faultless, holy Son of God, does have enemies. And often he prayed, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. But there is a line where it will be perfectly appropriate for Jesus to say, in the name of the Lord, I will destroy them. And in the battle of Armageddon, he will. The enemies surrounded him like bees, hurting him, wounding him, shredding him. Verses 10 through 13, the third stop, Golgotha. Jesus alone has the moral authority to speak of destroying his enemies. Jesus alone has the moral authority to speak of destroying his enemies. And then verses 14 through 18 bring us to the next stop on the Lord's journey home. The Lord is my strength and my song, and has become my salvation. Calvary is past. The voice of rejoicing and salvation is in the tabernacles of the righteous. The right hand of the Lord doeth valiantly. The right hand of the Lord is exalted. The right hand of the Lord doeth valiantly. I shall not die but live and declare the works of the Lord. Because he lives, we too shall live. Up from the grave he arose, and this is the fourth major stop on the Lord's journey home. And it's glory, it's glory, it's victory, it's triumph. Gethsemane, Gabbatha, Golgotha, and glory. Well, I promised that we would finish up a brief exposition of the song in which we find John Wycliffe's text. Turn now, please, to the book of Ruth. The book of Ruth. Ruth, chapter 1. Ruth 1, verse 1. Ruth 1, verse 1. Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled, that there was a famine in the land. And a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to sojourn in the country of Moab. He and his wife and his two sons. And the name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife, Naomi, and the name of his two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah. And they came into the country of Moab and continued there. Now verse 22. We're not going to take the time to read about the social development of the family down in Moab. But the time came when Naomi decided to go back home to Bethlehem, Judah. Now verse 22. So Naomi returned, and Ruth, the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law with her, which returned out of the country of Moab. And they came to Bethlehem in the beginning of barley harvest. It was barley harvest time when Naomi returned home to Bethlehem, accompanied by one daughter-in-law, Ruth. Barley was a staple crop around Bethlehem. Indeed, Bethlehem, Beth-lechem, means the house of bread. Barley was a main staple agriculturally around Bethlehem. The very name of the town means house of bread. Now turn over to Micah. Micah chapter number 5. Micah 5, 2. Micah 5, 2. But thou, Bethlehem Ephratah, though thou be little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of thee shall he come forth unto me, that is to be ruler in Israel, whose goings forth have been from of old, from everlasting. Now turn to Matthew. Matthew 2. Matthew 2, verse 1. You are beginning to see the thread. Matthew 2, 1. Now when Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, behold, there came wise men from the east to Jerusalem, saying, where is he that is born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east, and are come to worship him. When Herod the king had heard these things, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And when he had gathered all the chief priests and scribes of the people together, he demanded of them where Christ, Messiah, should be born. And they said unto him, in Bethlehem of Judea. For thus it is written by the prophet. Well, we've just seen that in Micah 5, 2. And thou, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, art not the least among the princes of Judah. The princes of Judah. For out of thee shall come a governor that shall rule my people Israel. Now turn, please, to the book of John. Book of John. John chapter 6. John 6, 30. Jesus had been doing miracles, but many of the people were still skeptical. And in John chapter 6, verse 30, we read, they said therefore unto Jesus, what sign showest thou then, that we may see and believe thee? What dost thou work? Our fathers did eat manna in the desert, as it is written, he gave them bread from heaven to eat. Then Jesus said unto them, Verily, verily, I say unto you, Moses gave you not that bread from heaven, but my Father giveth you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is he which cometh down from heaven and giveth life unto the world. Then said they unto Jesus, Lord, evermore give us this bread. And Jesus said unto them, I am. I am. That's the tetragrammaton, the verb of eternal existence. I am. I am the bread of life. He that cometh to me shall never hunger, and he that believeth on me shall never thirst. Now go over, please, to verse 47 as we come to our last verses at this point. Verse 47 of the same chapter of John. Verily, verily, our Lord is talking again still. I say unto you, he that believeth on me hath everlasting life. I am that bread of life. Your fathers did eat manna in the wilderness and are dead. This is the bread which cometh down from heaven, that a man may eat thereof and not die. I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If any man eat of this bread, he shall live forever. And the bread that I will give is my flesh, which I will give for the life of the world. And verse 58. This is that bread which came down from heaven, not as your fathers that eat manna and are dead. He that eateth of this bread shall live forever. His name was Jan or John Hus. His name was Jan, J-A-N, or John, means the same thing, Hus. I am assigning a text to Jan Hus because the name of the church where he preached personifies his life commitment. The name of the church where he preached personifies and speaks of his life commitment. Jan Hus preached to the flock at Bethlehem Chapel in Prague, Czechoslovakia. That was the name of the church where Hus preached. It was Bethlehem Chapel. The chapel had been founded in 1391, and Jan Hus became the chapel preacher in 1402, only 11 years after that local church chapel ministry was begun. You can understand then that Jan Hus played a very strategic role in that church that was only 11 years old. The pastors that come to a church early in its ministry tend to have a great influence. They tend to be very formative, even as people here still talk about the founder, Pastor Freeman Googe, and people still talk about Everett W. Bixler. The pastors who come in the beginning tend to leave a very strong mark on the church. And Jan Hus came to the chapel called the House of Bread Chapel, when the Bethlehem Chapel, the House of Bread Chapel, was only 11 years old. God planned that he should be there at that strategic time in the history of the House of Bread Chapel in Prague. Though Hus became famous and infamous to some as a reformer, He never lost the sense that his primary calling was to feed the people of the local church. Huss became well known, and he paid a great price for his notoriety. He paid a great price. He became famous, infamous, for those who chose to have Huss as their enemy. But he never forgot that his first calling was to the people of the local flock, the people back there at the House of Bread, the Bethlehem Chapel. Huss never forgot that his first calling was to feed the people at the House of Bread Chapel with the Word, the bread of heaven. I'm thinking right now, and forgive me, but I suppose it's a mark of growing older. The older you get, the fewer inhibitions you have, the less you have to lose. You've seen that little cartoon of a little old lady, and she said, when I grow old, I'm going to wear purple and jump up and down on everybody's bed. When I grow old, I'm just going to do whatever I want. I don't have to win friends and please people anymore. It's all over. I've won the friends I'm going to win, and I've made the enemies I'm going to make. There's nothing to lose, nothing to gain. I'll just wear purple and jump up and down in everybody's bed when I go to visit them. Well, I guess I'm getting there. And this morning I wore purple. And I suppose the next step downward is the jumping up and down on the bed. And so I'll say something very candid. I'm very aware now of a pastor who pastors at you. Well, that's the official term. He's just hardly ever there. He's always gone. Monday through Friday, he just breezes in. Just breezes in to preach on Sunday. And then he's gone again, giving seminars to tell people how to raise money for churches. One of the founders of the church died. He didn't even take the funeral. They called a former pastor from Alabama, and the former pastor drove all the way back from Alabama to take the funeral of one of the founders of the church who had invested his life in that church. I don't call that kind of a pulpiteer a pastor. Every local church is supposed to be a house of bread, Bethlehem, Bethlehem, to feed the people, to pastor them. The church is not just a preaching post where preachers breeze through to do their oratory and impress people and wow people and then breeze on and pick up some seminar fees. Though Huss became famous and infamous, he never forgot that his primary calling was to feed the people in the local flock that gathered at the House of Bread Chapel, to feed them the bread that comes down from heaven. So, I am assigning the text, John 6, 34, to John Huss. I'll say that again. I am assigning the text, John 6, 34, to John Huss. Then said they unto Jesus, Lord, evermore give us this bread. Evermore give us this bread. Tozer said the day would come in American churches where the sheep would look up and beg to be fed, and all they'd be getting would be the chaff of entertainment. And too often we're there. A.W. Tozer was way before his time. He was a prophet. He knew what was coming, and he wrote those editorials in the Alliance Witness. And people subscribed to the Christian and Missionary Alliance Witness just to read Tozer's editorials. They wouldn't read much else in the Alliance Witness. They paid for the magazine just to read Tozer's editorials. And they said, the time will come when the hungry sheep will look up. They won't be fed. There'll be no doctrine left. It'll all be entertainment. Oh, this text speaks of us. Evermore, give us this bread. Now, why do I assign John 6:34 to John Huss? I'll give you yet another reason. This is literal. John Huss clearly stated that his pastoral goal was to, and I quote, to lead some poor, tired, blind, or halting, limping soul into the house of Christ, to the supper of the King. So I'm back to the bread. And that's why I assigned the text, Lord, evermore give us this bread. He saw his calling as to lead the poor, the tired, the blind, the halting into the house of Christ, to the supper of the King. Huss insisted that his hearers eat God's bread, not the chaff of the popes. And when we come to the history of Huss, we will see that religion, the state church, married too closely to government, they had several popes at the same time. And the popes were in rivalry with each other. Huss insisted that his hearers eat God's bread, not the chaff of the popes and the archbishops. And Huss would die a martyr for his purist positions. Huss was a purist. He said, these things are not in the Bible. And he preached against them. And he wrote books against the chaff of the popes and the archbishops. As they led him to be burned at the stake, they had planned it. They led him past a book burning ceremony for his books. They said, Huss, there are your books. When you die, the things you've taught die. And he just laughed as they led him past the bonfire of his own books and said, those are your books, Huss. He just laughed. And he was burned alive singing. Evermore give us this bread. He knew that the desire of the common man for the bread from above would outlive him. And he knew that the desire for spiritual bread in the hearts of common people would win over the tyranny of the popes. He knew that the soul hunger of the human heart was stronger than the dictates of the popes and archbishops. He knew that the common people were pleading, evermore give us this bread. And though he lost, he won. And though he died, he lives. John Huss would die answering the call of the common people of Prague. Evermore, give us this bread. I'm going to close up here with a few words of commentary from D.A. Carson. But before I read D.A. Carson's observations on this text, evermore give us this bread. Understand that verse 35 follows the text. Let's look at 35 of John 6. And Jesus said to them, I am the bread of life. He that cometh to me shall never hunger, and he that believeth on me shall never thirst. Verse 35 is our Lord's answer to the request of the common people in 34. D.A. Carson observantly points out that we know that this talk about the bread is a metaphor for something much larger than earthly bread because of the verb cometh and because of the verb believeth. We know it's a picture. We know it's a metaphor about something much bigger than earthly bread. You say, well, how do we know that? Well, normally we eat bread, period. But Jesus says the kind of bread he's talking about is the kind of bread that you can come to. He says that the kind of bread he's talking about is the kind of bread that you can believe on. That's no ordinary bread. Would you agree? When's the last time you've come to the bread? Sure, I know. You went to the supper table last night, and as you sat down, I know you said, I'm coming to the bread. No, you didn't. At most, you said, I'm going to eat my supper, and it's a sandwich with some bread on it. I'm going to eat the bread. You didn't say, I'm coming to the bread, nor did you say, oh, I'm going to believe on the bread. No, you ate the bread. Jesus takes this word picture much further, and he says, the kind of bread I'm talking about is the bread that you come to, and the kind of bread that you believe. Oh. He makes it plain that he's talking way beyond bread from an earthly table. And he says, if there's still any doubt, he says, I am. I am the bread that you can come to. And I am the bread that you can believe on. And if you come to my kind of bread, and if you believe on me as the bread of life, you'll never die spiritually. You will live forever spiritually. And so John Huss, obedient to the Lord and the simplicity of the New Testament, and eventually he sealed his message with his life because he saw that the common people were saying, oh, evermore give us this bread. Give us the bread that you can come to. Give us the bread you can believe on. Give us Jesus and the simplicity of his word. Now, what about you? Have you ever come to the bread? Do you eat regularly in Bethlehem Chapel? Do you have personal devotions? Do you ever open the Bible from Sunday to Sunday? You know, I'll give you a little hint. If you're spiritually alive, you'll want to come to the spiritual bread, and you'll want to believe. And if you never come to the eternal bread, just count yourself lost. Just count yourself affiliated, but never regenerated, Baptist, but not born again. If you don't have a desire for the bread, just count yourself unregenerate. People who've been birthed from above have a spiritual hunger, and they say, evermore give us this bread. Oh, you say, well, I'm going to chew in Hollywood. Yes, won't you? Yes, won't you? And you'll just be like Whitney Houston. Oh, I'm just going to feed on rock. Yeah. And you'll just be like Nirvana and Michael Jackson. Yeah, you'll feed on that. And you'll end up just like them. Empty, addicted, paying doctors to abuse their oath? Killing yourself and putting the doctors in jail for a good while. The only thing that will prevent that is for you to be born again and get a hunger for the eternal bread.
We trust you have been encouraged or strengthened by the word today. We would love to hear from you. You can email us at graceglory7@juno.com. That's graceglory7@juno.com. We will reply to all those who contact us. And now, until next time, may the good Lord bless and keep you.